It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. Curtis Jensen is the portfolio manager of the OSHA Partners Fund. Before joining Robotti and Company in 2016, Curtis was employed by Third Avenue Management in various roles from 1995 to 2014. Curtis oversaw that firm's small cap strategy, and from 2003 until 2009, he also served as co-chief investment officer along with Marty Wittman. Curtis holds a BA in economics from Williams College and an MBA from the Yale School of Management. On behalf of the MOI Global Membership Community, a very warm welcome back to you, Curtis. Please go ahead.
John, thank you for that very kind introduction. I'm always honored to be included in such a distinguished and interesting group. As you alluded to, I partnered with Bob Robotti about 3 years ago, and really on one key criteria, which was trying to find good people, which I defined as people with the highest integrity, who were financially conservative and just passionate about investing. And 3 years ago, I felt like the investing landscape was a bit like an episode from the Twilight Zone. There were trillions in negative yielding fixed income. I thought it was kind of distorting the cost of capital and meant that the risk of capital getting misallocated was growing astronomically. Secondly, of course, there was this tsunami of fund flows away from active managers into passive strategies, indexes, momentum-based strategies, approaches that were driven by non-fundamental considerations that really had nothing to do with economic reality. And so for me, it was, the death of price discovery in the public markets. Lastly, you had, there were headlines filled with the obituaries of hedge funds and mutual funds who discovered that their business models were broken. And, I was personally aware of dozens of managers who were getting liquidated every single day. There were no natural buyers on the other side. So, another source of pressure on stocks, particularly in smaller and mid-cap types of stocks. Here we are 3 years later. All three of those elements remain in place. And, we've layered in a high level of uncertainty related to tariffs and trade wars and, frankly, a lot of social and political upheaval around the globe. So if anything, the environment in my mind has ripened for anyone with a value-conscious approach that's able and willing to do something that's differentiated. From what I can tell, more and more investors, whether it's at the fund level or even at the institutional level, to me, they just look more and more like sheep doing the same things. They're flocking to the same names, rationalizing their ownership in certain companies. And in the case of institutions, I think they're chasing returns in private equity and venture capital. So I have a hunch that prospective returns over the next, I'll call it 5 to 10 years, and for those pools of capital will be significantly lower than what they have been historically, and I think it's already happening. So it's another way of saying, I suppose, you have to do something different, potentially radically different, to paraphrase Templeton, which means having the right capital sources and the right structure to invest. I think about it, a lot of fiduciaries and allocators get caught up in the debate around value versus growth. And I would, argue that that debate is phony baloney. The two are attached at the hip. You can't have value without growth, in my mind. So for me, it's not value investing or growth investing per se. There really is only kind of rational investing. And for me, rational investing starts with considering downsides. And this slide sort of reminds me of the four main areas where I tend to get in trouble. Investors always interested in, where I find ideas. You know, I have two ideas for today's talk, and I think it'll really kind of draw from one of these buckets, probably a combination of what I might call capital flight and just kind of peer network coming together in terms of the origination of these ideas. I suppose one theme that kind of emerged for much of this year for me was just the utter disdain for commodities and materials and industrial stocks. You know, with every tweet about tariffs and trade, the market seemed to be on a hair trigger. You know, it was very much a shoot first, ask questions later, total risk off posture for much of the year. And one of the places that seemed to be particularly out of favor was Canada. You know, it makes some sense if you think investors are in a risk off mode. One of the things you would avoid, or those investors would avoid, is commodities, whether it's in energy, chemicals, metals, what have you. And Canada is obviously an economy that's, you know, heavily dependent on commodities. And so I started connecting some of the dots, and especially around late summer. It was a time that I noticed a lot of cyclical stocks had sold off significantly. And as I was talking to one Canadian executive, you know, his comment was, if you're a small cap commodities company, there's no bid for your stock. So I collected a few headlines on the slide just to kind of illustrate the point. There was a tremendous amount of negative narrative around commodities and particularly Canada. And if you were to make allocations based on historical returns, you know, you can see I put up a chart here comparing Canada to the MSCI world. There's no way you would be allocating to Canadian equities. And so I thought about all of this, and it kind of piqued my curiosity. And it jived with a lot of history that I've had investing mostly with good results in Canadian companies. So my first idea is a company called Stelco. I came across it when I heard the chairman of the company is a guy named Alan Kestenbaum. He was speaking in the springtime at the Ivy Conference in Toronto. And I really liked what I heard, but I didn't think the stock was necessarily cheap enough. So I added it to my screen and kind of watched it. You know, at the time, the stock was probably in the mid-teens, maybe 15 or 16. And this summer, it kind of fell into that 10, 11 range. And at that point, one of my partners had mentioned to me, you know, reminded me that we had seen Alan Kestenbaum, suggested we dust off the name. And, you know, long about September, I saw the stock was down 40% year to date or something like that, owing to kind of U.S.-Canada tariff issues. There was commentary from competitors around weakening end market conditions. So it was sort of this kind of perfect storm, if you will. Stelco is an integrated steel producer with two production facilities, including the Hamilton Works and the Lake Erie Works. The company shipped about 2.5 million tons in 2018 for the full year. About three quarters of their production is hot rolled coil, with kind of coated products and cold rolled products making up the balance. Interesting to know, Lake Erie is maybe the newest greenfield integrated facility in North America, and management maintains that it's one of the lowest cost producers in North America. You know, both locations benefit from proximity to the lakes and highway transportation. And the company's got a storied history. It's, you know, as part of it used to be part of U.S. Steel. Stelco went into bankruptcy twice, I guess, but as part of U.S. Steel, it went into bankruptcy in 2014. They filed under CCAA, which is bankruptcy rule in Canada. A firm called Bedrock Industries, which is controlled by Alan Kestenbaum and Lindsay Goldberg, reorganized the company in that process, and the reorganization really helped to recapitalize the company's balance sheet. It came out with a debt-free balance sheet, and they were able to limit the company's liabilities, specifically around environmental pension liabilities, healthcare liabilities, things that had dogged U.S. Steel when they owned the company for several years. As I mentioned, over the course of 2019, this year, the stock was hammered as, fears about tariffs, softening global growth, pre-announcements from competitors, all kind of created this recipe to put a lot of pressure on Stelco's stock. One of the things that I've noticed, my experience has been with companies that are coming out of bankruptcy, and sometimes, you see it in spinoffs as well. They're sort of orphans, and often cases, the companies themselves are orphans inside other companies. Therefore, they didn't receive adequate capital to build the business, build their market share, innovate, all those things. And I think some of that happened as well at Stelco. I think the prior management at U.S. Steel was under a lot of pressure, and they had underinvested in the business. They had lost market share in the auto sector specifically. And, the current management team is making investments in the business, which, ought to restore some of that market share and help the earning power of the business. For example, they put in a batch annealing facility this year at Hamilton. It was one of the first investments of new equipment that facility has seen probably in 20 or 30 years. Hamilton's got excess capacity, and if you were able to kind of further process, you can make better products suited to automotive applications, for example. And, the press reports in the local media suggested, the workers and the management at Hamilton were ecstatic. This was a huge morale booster for them. So even rather modest investments can go a long way and ought to help the business here. The company is interesting because it does sit on a lot of excess land, probably 500 of the 700 acres the company's properties are located on are potentially leasable and saleable. And the company is currently starting to lease some industrial property around their work. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that, the land around Toronto is scarce and highly valuable. And management has made it pretty clear that, there are higher and better uses for the land. And, they're in the process of trying to monetize that land. So you have a company that is, they're cyclically, the earnings are cyclically depressed, but I don't think there's any, you don't have to make any heroic assumptions to think they can get back to earning, a couple of dollars a share or more. At September 30th, the company had, I think about $3 and change in cash. I would assign probably a couple of bucks in value to the net operating losses. And I think there are sort of credible estimates out there and of value for the real estate in sort of the $4 or $5 a share range. So I think there's a lot of downside protection in the assets here. And I think there are kind of multiple ways to win if you have patience. So I think that one's, fairly interesting. Just as a side note, Fairfax bought an interest in Stelco. They now own 15% of the company, but they bought 15% of the shares from Bedrock at about $20 a share. And today the stock is 11. So Prem is sitting with an unrealized loss on his Stelco holdings. But as I said, I think there's significant value above even where Fairfax bought the shares. The second name is a company called Clark Inc. It's an investment company that, trading at a discount to the sum of its parts. I'd call it part private equity, part public activist. They engage with in their minority investments in public companies, often with a board role. I put the logos of a few of the major investments of Clark on the screen here. Holloway operates a small group of limited service hotels across Canada. Clark and Holloway had a large overlap in their shareholder base. Holloway had been public up until this year, up until very recently. They recognized that they had a large overlap in their shareholder base, so it made sense to put everything under one company, eliminate the cost of having a second public company. Clark now can control its destiny in the investment. And Holloway, they've been selling properties in almost all cases at a gain. They had 33 properties. They're down to 18. And so they're moving the portfolio to kind of focus on their best properties, reposition others. They're being very opportunistic about it. Management will be the first one to tell you that, this sort of limited service hotel business where you've got branded strategy, it's a very tough business. I mean, depreciation in the hotel business is very real. Consumers demand, a fresh look more quickly than, accounting standards and accounting schedules might otherwise allow. Branded strategy means they're less able to control, their marketing. But they're, like I said, they're repositioning some of the properties. There's no emotional ties to this asset. Management's very focused on, maximizing the value of the business. TerraVest is publicly traded. It manufactures a wide range of tanks and storage products and energy processing equipment. They serve both industrial customers as well as residential customers. They've got a small energy services business. And really, the track record of growth is pretty good. They've grown through small bolt-on acquisitions. The business is cash generative. It's got a good balance sheet. And they make pretty good returns. And I'd say right now, the business is probably under-earning its potential. And they make everything from storage and transportation tanks to, if you think about home heating oil, fuel, refined fuel storage tanks, tanks for energy processing, even water storage tanks, and the like. So it sounds like a kind of a mundane business, but they've actually created a business that is growing and getting pretty good returns. Trican is an energy services company in Western Canada. Dreary outlook, short term for energy in Canada. Their portfolio includes everything from, coil tubing to fracking services, fluid management, cementing services, engineering support, pretty much, covering most of a well's life cycle. But geographically, the assets are deployed in prolific areas like the Montney and Duvernay and Deep Basin in Western Canada. The company's massively delevered in the last couple of years. They had assets in, Russian assets, I think. They had assets in the United States. They've sold that. Today they have a very strong balance sheet, which I think is a huge advantage for the company. Management's repurchased 19% of the shares in the last 24 months. They've made some opportunistic acquisitions, and they've cut costs. And they continue to sell opportunistically bits of equipment and real estate that they don't need. So I think they've got a really solid record as allocators and as operators, and just doing a good job. The stock is maybe a fraction, it's at a fraction of book value, maybe half of book value. Clearly under earning in the cyclically depressed conditions. So again, I think there's credible downside support and potential for significant upside. One of the issues for Clark, historically as a public company, has been the float. They've been a relatively small, micro-cap type of company, high insider ownership. And so therefore, there was very, very limited float. The stock was illiquid. One of the benefits of buying Holloway with stock, which is what they did this year, is that it's expanded both the market cap and the float for Clark. So when you add up the pieces, you can kind of, you look at it as sum of the parts basis, and depending on your assumptions, it may be anywhere from 15% to 30% or more undervalued. This sum of the parts is borrowed from management's presentation. Normally, I wouldn't count on management's presentation, but one can apply, his or her own assumptions here. I don't use it as necessarily as a guide to what the thing is worth, but I think it's some perspective to suggest that there are multiple sources of value in Clark. I spent, a fair bit of time with the CEO, Michael Raps. He is not a wild-eyed optimist, and he's not overly, he's not trying to pump the stock. He's not promotional. And I think he's pretty rigorous in his assessments. He's deep in the weeds on his businesses. And I think you could view Clark as almost like a closed-end private equity-like fund trading at a discount. And, I'd say the CEO, Michael Raps, really has kind of an outsider type of mentality. So those are my two ideas. Canada seems to be on the outs. I think of it as potentially kind of interesting here. And, with that, maybe I'd open it up to questions.
Curtis, thank you very much for the presentation and both idea theses. If you could elaborate a little bit on capital allocation, I'm wondering whether there's anything you might prioritize differently than the management is doing in each case.
I in the case of Stelco, it's clear that management has a they act very countercyclically, which means that they will likely buy assets when things are very depressed. If you think about it, that's 180 degrees different than most management teams, right? They tend to act pro-cyclically. They're buying things when things are good. But Stelco will probably. The management team there, I have the sense that they will, hold off on share repurchases, for example, and, avoid paying a special dividend, for example, and not returning capital to shareholders when they're able to buy assets or expand their operations and invest in the business. So from my perspective, I think that's wonderful. And the same is true at Clark. I mean, George R. Moyen, you really ought to Google him and learn more. He's a very interesting character. I believe he made most of his fortune in real estate, again, buying things that were out of favor. Michael Raps, he's very much approaching this thing from a, historically buying distressed assets. And like a Trican, for example, when things are depressed, the stock's down, they'll take advantage of it to repurchase a lot of stock and when things are down. And I, frankly, a lot of companies, I see them buying back stock when their stock is hitting all-time highs, and I kind of scratch my head. And then when things are bad or conditions are bad, business conditions are bad and the stock's down, they avoid buying back stock, maybe out of, the board's overly cautious or something. But in both cases, I think the capital allocation has been and will continue to be very beneficial for the businesses and ultimately the value of the equity.
It seems like there's strong downside protection in each case as well. Can you think of any scenario that would see equity impaired beyond where the stocks are trading?
I think one of the advantages, I mean, one of the ways I've tried, I'm not in love with the steel business. Let me say that. I haven't invested in a lot of steel businesses precisely because of what you saw happen with U.S. Steel. I mean, it's very competitive, it's capital intensive, it's cyclical. You have all these obligations to, retirees, healthcare obligations, pension obligations, environmental liabilities. So I've kind of avoided it, but I think Stelco is a little bit unique in the sense that they've come out of bankruptcy with a clean balance sheet. They're able to structure things so as to kind of cap their liabilities going forward in terms of pensions. They did some creative things there. And, if you look around at their competitors, most of them are still strapped with all these legacy liabilities and highly leveraged balance sheets. So I think in the case of Stelco, I would never pray for a recession, but if business conditions get very weak, I think they'll be uniquely positioned to take advantage of that. So a strong balance sheet and an absence of really, burdensome off-balance sheet liabilities, I think positions them well for a downturn. And the same thing, I think, with Clark's businesses. In each case, there's financial capital structure, financially sound financing in terms of diverse sources of finance, and similarly able, not only from a balance sheet perspective, but from a management capability perspective, able to take advantage of a downturn. And so, and I think the stocks are down a lot, and in each case, in reflecting, yeah, these things are economically sensitive. Yes, there's a tilt towards energy materials, commodities, and but I think a lot of that's discounted by the current prices.
Great. Well, I will leave it there. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with their own thoughts or questions. Thank you very much for showing your contact information here on the screen as well. Curtis, it's always a pleasure to have you here and benefit from your insights and ideas, and I truly appreciate you taking the time to do it again for us today.
It's always great for me, and I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much, and I hope everyone enjoys the holidays and as we a great start to the new year.
Thank you so much, and best wishes to you and everybody at Robotti as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye
Bye
for
now.
now.